Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, we'll have some important information for San Diego County residents and businesses that suffered damages in those severe January storms. After a federal disaster declaration, FEMA has opened up flood relief centers in Spring Valley and Mountain View communities, and it's important to apply for the federal aid, even if you've already gone to a county center. The IRS has announced delayed tax filing deadlines to help local flood victims, and so has the county tax assessor. A Spring Valley community group is seeking donated items to help those in Spring Valley who were impacted by storm damages. And then on Crime Beat, we'll have a report on the shooting of three people at a dental clinic in East County, as well as the arrest of a sex offender in El Cajon. On Green Scene, hear about efforts to reopen trails at Loveland Reservoir and a hearing coming up in Alpine seeking public input. The Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College has reopened while it transitions to new management, and we'll have details. Cajon Valley Union School District Trustee Joe Alegria has resigned, leaving a vacancy to be filled. County supervisors have approved plans to spend remaining ARPA funds on projects ranging from helping the homeless to creating affordable housing, and we'll have details. The county is offering free hands-on CPR training in hopes of saving lives across our region. And the City of La Mesa is seeking artists to create new murals for its Walkway of the Stars, honoring community volunteers. Then on Destination East County, we'll tell you about many festive springtime events sprouting up across East County, from a daffodil festival to tomato mania to an Earth Day celebration and much more. April is Women's History Month, and today we'll be remembering Helen Stoddard, a suffrage leader who helped lead efforts to grant California women the right to vote and for La Mesa to become a city more than a century ago. From Public News Service, we'll have an update on severe blizzards and avalanches in California's Sierra Nevada mountains and more national news. From California News Service, we'll have reports on how social services are reducing crime and on efforts to bring college dropouts back to complete their educations. We'll also have tips from Master Gardener Connie Beck on Ready, Set, Grow, with tips on how to attract butterflies and hummingbirds to your garden. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has opened two local disaster recovery centers. They're open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Residents who had damage from the floods that occurred January 21st through 23rd can visit these centers to register or register online for federal disaster relief to help pay for repairs, temporary housing, and property losses, as well as business loans now through April 19th. The federal aid comes after President Joe Biden issued a federal disaster declaration for our region. The FEMA centers are located at the Spring Valley County Library on Kempton Street in Spring Valley and at the Mountain View Community Center in San Diego. The centers will offer information from the U.S. Small Business Administration, state agencies, and the County of San Diego, as well as FEMA. Residents can also go online at disasterassistance.gov, use the FEMA mobile app, or call the FEMA helpline at 800-621-3362. Again, that's 800-621-3362. The line is available from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Supervisors have voted unanimously to ask staff to draft an ordinance to delay the April 10th property tax filing deadline for victims of the January floods that impacted East San Diego communities, as well as Lemon Grove, Spring Valley, and other areas. The action was proposed by Shane Harris, president of the People's Association of Justice Advocates, along with Jordan Marks, the county tax assessor. Harris told supervisors, "Businesses, families, and residents across our region deserve to have the tax clock paused for a moment as they focus on rebuilding their lives and livelihoods." Chairman Nora Vargas and Supervisor Monica Montgomery Stepp put the item on the agenda. Marks, who toured flooded neighborhoods with Harris, said, "I smelled the mold and I saw the damage. which inspired me to work with Shane to figure out how my office could do more. Staff is expected to bring the tax deferral ordinance back to supervisors for a final reading on March 12th. If supervisors approve it on March 12th, then the ordinance will go into effect countywide and allow businesses, homeowners, and others who own damaged properties to apply for a deferral of their property taxes through the county assessor's office. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, your network for social justice, this is John Tidwell.
The Internal Revenue Service has announced tax relief for individuals and businesses in areas with disaster declarations designated by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. This includes San Diego County residents and businesses impacted by the severe storms and flooding that began January 21st. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs announced she is grateful that the IRS answered my call for tax relief for San Diegans. These taxpayers now have until June 17th to file various federal individual and business tax returns and make tax payments. These include individual income tax returns, IRA, and health savings account contributions, quarterly payroll, and excise tax returns, as well as tax returns for corporations and nonprofits. The IRS automatically provides filing and penalty relief to any taxpayer with an IRS address of record in the disaster area. These taxpayers do not need to contact the agency to get this relief. In addition, the IRS will work with any taxpayer who lives outside the disaster area but whose records necessary to meet a deadline during the postponement period are in the affected area. Taxpayers qualifying for relief who live outside the disaster area need to contact the IRS. This also includes workers assisting the relief activities who are affiliated with a recognized government or philanthropic organization. Taxpayers can also exclude from their gross income any money received from a government agency for reasonable and necessary living expenses, costs to repair their home, or to replace damaged contents. Some individual retirement arrangement or IRA accounts allow taxpayers to take a special disaster distribution not subject to the normal 10% early distribution tax. Taxpayers may also be eligible to make a hardship withdrawal. Each plan or IRA has specific rules and guidance for their participants to follow. The tax relief is part of a coordinated federal response to the damage caused by these storms and is based on local damage assessments by FEMA. For information on disaster recovery, visit disasterassistance.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Danita Ramirez.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Zervon with the People's Power Report. While the waters receded quickly from the thousand-year flood on January 22nd, more than 200 Spring Valley homes were left badly impacted. Cars, furniture, appliances, and other essential belongings were left severely damaged or destroyed. Chris Pierce, Vice President of the Spring Valley Community Alliance, says, "Many Spring Valley residents were left with the clothes on their backs and the items they could grab as they attempted to escape the rising waters. Residents need help beyond what the county has offered, and through federal disaster declaration has been issued, many residents have immediate needs. So the Spring Valley Community Alliance has mobilized a coalition of churches, communities, organizations, and residents to help. They have opened a site, the Spring Valley Community Church on Bancroft Drive, to collect and distribute donations for those affected. The donation site opens Monday through Thursday, 10 a.m. to noon, from now through April 15th. You can drop off donated items that are in new or good condition, including bedding, blankets, towels, baby items, cleaning supplies, personal care products, and kitchen items, such as dishes, cookware, and small appliances. For those wanting to donate furniture or larger appliances, please contact floodrelief@svca.org. Since drop-off location will not have enough space, so large items must be managed separately. For more information, visit the Spring Valley Community Alliance at thecvca.org. SCVA.org.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report. A disgruntled patient opened fire inside an El Cajon dental clinic on Thursday, February 29th, killing Dr. Benjamin Haruni, a dentist who ran the Smile Plus Dentistry and Orthodontics Clinic along with his father. Two other employees were injured. The shooting suspect, 29-year-old Mohammed Abdul Karim, was arrested after an intensive manhunt. He has been charged with murder and two counts of attempted murder. Although Dr. Haruni was Jewish and the shooting suspect is Arab, Fabien Perloff, regional director of the Anti-Defamation League in San Diego, says that its Center on Extremism has not identified any extremist or hate-related motivation behind the shootings at this point. The carnage might have been worse if not for the swift response by El Cajon police. After receiving reports of gunshots in the clinic at 4:14 p.m., officers arrived 2 minutes later and found the three gunshot victims. According to Yeshiva World News, Dr. Haruni was found inside the office as the shooting was still ongoing and was taken outside by officers where they attempted to perform life-saving measures, but he died at the scene. A front office worker, 28-year-old Yareli Carrillo, was shot in the legs, her father Jose Antonio told NBC7. The third victim was a man in his 40s. Both were taken to a hospital and are expected to survive. The suspect fled the scene in a white U-Haul pickup truck he had rented earlier in the day. El Cajon's license plate reading camera system identified the getaway vehicle. Shortly after 9 p.m., ECPC sent out images of the suspect and the pickup on social media, warning that he was armed and dangerous. Around 10 p.m., a witness spotted the pickup truck parked near Balboa Park in San Diego. San Diego police found Abdul Karim in the vicinity and arrested him. He was armed with a loaded handgun and several handgun magazines, all purchased legally 2 weeks before the shooting, according to Captain Royal Bates with El Cajon Police. The FBI has joined in the investigation, as is customary if a federal offense is suspected. El Cajon Police Chief Mike Moline said on Friday, "The El Cajon Police Department mourns with the family and friends of the deceased victim and extends heartfelt condolences to those injured in yesterday's senseless and evil act of violence." The police chief thanked local, state, and national agencies for their help during the investigation and processing of the crime scene. Other agencies involved include the U.S. Marshal Service Fugitive Task Force, La Mesa Police, San Diego County Sheriff's Office, San Diego County District Attorney's Office, ATF San Diego, and San Diego Police. Little information is yet available about the suspect. A LinkedIn profile under the name Locally indicates he worked in food service. A Facebook page under his name is blocked to non-friends. Anyone with information regarding this case is asked to call El Cajon Police at 619-579-3311 or to leave an anonymous tip, call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 or visit sdcrimestoppers.org.
This is Danita Ramirez with a Crime Beat report. 4 days after being released from jail, a homeless registered sex offender on parole is behind bars again. Samuel Salas was arrested February 26th after entering a woman's apartment on South Magnolia in El Cajon. Lieutenant Keith MacArthur with the El Cajon Police Department says the man grabbed a purse before the woman confronted him. The victim's daughter called the police as the man fled the apartment. Officers found the suspect a short distance away with keys from the management office. According to police, Salas has a lengthy arrest history, including indecent exposure after illegal entry into an occupied dwelling and a conviction for assault with intent to commit a sex offense. His most recent arrest was in December by El Cajon police for a parole violation.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Irvine with the Green Scene Report. A community workshop on trail improvements at Loveland Reservoir will be held on Thursday, March 14th at the Alpine Women's Club from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. State Senator Brian Jones convened at the workshop along with the Sweetwater Water Authority to hear from the residents concerned about the trail's erosion and limited public access. Due to the erosion caused by severe winter storms in January of last year, the damage occurred after the Sweetwater Water Authority severely drained the reservoir during the drought, exposing areas that suffered damage when the rain came. Senator Jones says, "Many of my consultants and Alpine have talked to me about their vision for Loveland Reservoir and their priorities for maintenance along the trails. As an avid outdoorsman, I love getting out into the trails and enjoying all that nature has to offer." At the collaborative roundhouse table, the community is encouraged to discuss ways to improve the trails and provide elected officials with resident priorities.
The Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College has reopened to the public on February 27th after the garden's Joint Powers Authority agreed to take over operations from the financially struggling nonprofit group Friends of the Water Conservation Garden. Following a brief closure, Interim Executive Director Lauren Magnuson announced that she's thrilled the garden is in bloom again. Hours will be limited initially to Tuesdays through Fridays from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and Saturdays 9 to 4. Education programs such as the Miss Smarty Plants are temporarily paused, however, until the operational transition is completed. The popular Tomato Mania event has been restored, and it will be held as originally scheduled on March 8th and 9th. At a three-hour meeting on February 23rd, the JPA board voted unanimously to send a notice of default terminating the Friends operation of the garden before the expiration of the June 30th operating agreement. The termination notice comes after the garden's former director, Jennifer Pillsbury, ran up roughly $1 million in loans to cover salaries and expenses during and after COVID, debts that Friends is unable to fully repay. Friends board president Michael Hager assured the JPA board that Friends will remain open and not shut down or file for bankruptcy at least until a $250,000 employee retention credit from the federal government arrives. A federal freeze on all ERC funds had put Friends in a financial bind, as it had retained employees in anticipation of those funds and later took out a series of loans while trying to stay afloat. Any funds in the Friends account are expected to be transferred to the JPA as part of the transition. Hager told the JPA, "Whatever is done, the Friends Board will work with you to make sure there is a smooth transition." The JPA, which is a 501c3 nonprofit itself, did operate the garden in the past, before the Friends Board was created. Initially, the Friends Board focused on fundraising. Going forward, short term, five of the JPA's member water agencies will each put in about $5,000 a month through June to reopen the garden and cover bare bones operations, estimated at about $100,000 from March through June. Numerous speakers at the JPA meeting urged that Interim Director Lauren Magnuson and Facilities Manager Tim Townsley be retained. The JPA agreed and approved employing the pair to run the garden along with volunteers while additional funds are sought to restore the education programs and more. Grossmont Cuyamaca Community College District Chancellor Lynn Nault agreed to cover insurance for the garden under the district's policy until the JPA can secure its own. Steve Zalesi, president of the volunteers, told the board, "We're dedicated. We're a family. We have a lot of resources you can bring to focus. Volunteers are working to reopen the gift shop and could also help write grants, teach classes, and help in other ways," he said. Volunteers and supporters of the garden packed the hearing room at Otay Water District for that JPA meeting. Carol Stevens, an avid gardener, said she's reduced her water usage to Tier 1, thanks to what she learned at the garden. Others spoke of bringing children and grandchildren and pets to enjoy the garden. Chancellor Nolt, a member of the JPA, assured the public, "I am deeply committed to keeping this garden open." Chairman Mark Roback made clear he also supports the garden's mission. He said, "The cheapest form of water savings is conservation." He also praised the efforts of volunteers at the Water Conservation Garden, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. JPA member Kathleen Hedberg, who's also a director on the Helix Water District Board, praised reopening of the garden as a success. In an email to her constituents, she added, "The long-term plan is still to be determined, but in the meantime, if you need inspiration on what to do for your landscape, please come by and spread the word." You can learn more about the Water Conservation Garden at thegarden.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
County supervisors have voted to expand the county's robust tree planting program in underserved communities in the unincorporated area. The board's actions allow the county to award contracts estimated at $2 million to buy about 4,000 trees, which will be planted this spring and summer. Funds will also be used to remove dead or diseased trees and install watering systems and equipment. The U.S. Forest Service estimates that California has lost more than 147 million trees since 2010. The county estimates 20 trees per acre were lost over 50,000 acres of county open space. So on August 31, 2022, the board approved development of an equity-driven tree planting program. The program focuses on identifying priority locations for tree planting in underserved areas. The county surpassed its goal of planting 10,000 trees last year, adding more than 11,000 to parks and facilities across our region. Since 2016, the county has planted over 35,000 trees in county parks to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Plants and trees extract the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide from the air and use it to grow through photosynthesis. Several large volunteer events contributed to the county tree plantings. The county's Parks and Recreation Tree Planting Program is part of the county's Climate Action Plan, with an overall goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The county plants a variety of healthy native and climate-ready trees that adapt to changing temperatures. These types of trees also help prevent tree infestation by pests. More trees help clean the air, provide shade, and cool air temperatures in the surrounding environment. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Danita Ramirez with an education report. Cajon Valley School District Trustee Joe Alegria has resigned, leaving a vacancy to be filled. She has served on the Cajon Valley Union School District Board for nearly a decade, including as board president. In her resignation letter, Alegria said it has been an honor and a privilege to serve on the board, adding that she believes passionately in the importance of public education and public service. Alegria, who recently started a job as a bus driver for MTS, indicated that she is leaving to fulfill her obligations as an employee in a new position. Her resignation comes after she missed two board meetings and after critics posted negative remarks on social media. In her resignation letter, she said she has experienced disgraceful personal attacks that she said are false and misleading. She concluded, "We are role models for students, and it is important that no one be bullied or intimidated by lies or innuendo. I have not served in this position to gain popularity, nor do I believe that any of my fellow board members do so." She urged other board members to continue to do the right thing for the district and do not allow threats or intimidation to obstruct your obligations to do the right thing. Alegria did not specify the nature of the personal attacks on social media. However, Times of San Diego reports that Ashley Carnevale, wife of Cajon Valley trustee Anthony Carnevale, had accused Alegria of trolling her husband and stalking the couple's children online under an alias. She had asked the school board to adopt a policy prohibiting board members from following, engaging with, or stalking district students on social media. The district has 60 days after Alegria's resignation took effect February 21st to either appoint someone to fill the vacancy or order a special election.
The County Board of Supervisors has voted unanimously on how to spend the final $102 million of American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, funds. In 2021, the county got $650 million in ARPA funds from the federal government and adopted a framework for spending it. ARPA is a stimulus bill that was meant to help the county recover from the COVID-19 pandemic and its economic and social impacts. The projected remaining $102 million in ARPA funds is broken down into two categories: $67 million in ARPA framework funds and $35 million dedicated for evergreen programs. The board approved the following breakdown of ARPA framework funds: $15 million for the Regional Homeless Assistance Program to support people in the unincorporated area, including East County, $10 million for COVID-related costs, $4.3 million to complete pilot programs like the Family Income for Empowerment Program, which gives families with kids under 18 years old $500 a month for 24 months, $27.1 million to continue running ARPA programs for things like homeless assistance, housing, and behavioral health sciences, and $10 million to be set aside in case FEMA does not reimburse the county for pandemic-era hotel rooms for vulnerable populations. For the evergreen component, which is for programs that have a lasting benefit on our region, including in behavioral health, housing, climate change, economic prosperity, homelessness, and workforce, the board voted to spend $15 million for implementation of Senate Bill 43, the Involuntary Behavioral Health Treatment Program, including public conservator infrastructure, crisis stabilization capacity, and substance use disorder treatment; $10.6 million for the Innovative Housing Trust Fund to create more affordable housing; $10 million to expand the county's behavioral health workforce, including recruitment, retention, and workforce development, and up to $10 million for natural disaster prevention and preparedness, pending reimbursement from FEMA of funds spent for the January storm relief. In the coming months, county staff will present to the Board of Supervisors more detailed recommendations on the approved ARPA spending. The county has until December of 2026 to fully spend all of the ARPA money. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Zeravon with a health report. The County of San Diego is partnering with UC San Diego to launch Revive and Survive San Diego, a new initiative to help save lives. The program aims to train 1 million San Diegans on how to perform hands-only. The program aims to train 1 million San Diegans on how to perform hands-only CPR for the people in cardiac arrest. Hands-only CPR involves chest compressions at 100 to 120 per minute without using mouth-to-mouth breathing. If someone can perform this before medical professionals arrive, it vastly increases a person's likelihood of survival. In recent years, CPR training has shifted from an hands-only approach. Mouth-to-mouth breathing is no longer considered essential. In 2021, 8% of the people who experienced an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in San Diego County were successfully revived and survived. Dr. Christine Koning, the county's Emergency Medical Service Medical Director and co-lead of the Revive and Survive San Diego Initiative, says, "Cardiac arrest continues to be the leading cause of death across the country." She adds, "No amount of preparation in a hospital can save a life if the person does not make it into the building. Receiving CPR at the scene will save lives. Brain death starts to occur 4 to 6 minutes after somebody experiences cardiac arrest. If there's no CPR or defibrillation during the time, for every minute CPR is delayed, survival from cardiac arrest decreases by 7 to 10%. Revive and Survive San Diego will work with local healthcare providers and community partner organizations to offer free hands-only CPR training and perform community outreach countywide. For more information about Revive and Survive San Diego, including opportunities for CPR training, becoming a partner, or supporting the initiative, you can visit revivesurvive.ucsd.edu. Again, that website is revivesurvive.uscd.edu.
The City of La Mesa is seeking proposals for the Walkway of the Stars mural project in downtown La Mesa. The walkway features decorative stones with stars naming volunteers who have given 10,000 hours or more of service to the City of La Mesa, as well as 8 community murals painted in 2003 depicting volunteerism in the city. This project will create up to 8 new murals along the walls of the walkway. Artists will be selected to create murals in spaces approximately 10.5 feet high with varying lengths from 12 to 18 feet. The theme of the Walkway of the Stars is honoring La Mesa's tradition of volunteerism. Their murals will follow the same theme. Artists can find guidelines on how to submit proposals on the City of La Mesa's website, cityoflamesa.us, in the Arts and Culture section. The deadline to submit proposals for the new murals is March 8th at 4 p.m. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Daneta Ramirez.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's Destination East County. With spring fast approaching, many festive and creative events are sprouting up across East County. These include Daffodil Days in Julian, Tomato Mania at the Water Conservation Garden, an Earth Day Fair in La Mesa, a plein air art show in Borrego Springs, a junior fair and barbecue in Lakeside, Nature Day on Mount Helix, Cajon Classic Cruises in El Cajon, plus plays, concerts, and a stargazing party. Julian Farm and Orchard invite you to enjoy Daffodil Days each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. from March 1st through April 14th, or whenever the beautiful yellow blooms are gone. The farm offers you-picked daffodils, as well as other farm activities, including a petting zoo, tractor-pulled hay rides, axe throwing, rock climbing wall, and a gift shop with locally crafted items and potted daffodils for sale. You can get more information at julianfarmandorchard.com. The 18th Annual Plein Air Invitational in Borrego Springs, California promises to be a captivating celebration of art and nature. The event runs from March 4th through April 14th. The Invitational centers around plein air paintings, which capture the unique beauty and environmental significance of the Anza Borrego Desert and Borrego Valley. While wildflowers are popping up now, the peak blooming usually occurs throughout March and continues into early April. Given all this winter's rain, the floral blooms in the Anza Borrego Desert are spectacular. 14 talented artists have been invited to create plein air outdoor paintings during the week of March 4th through 9th, inspired by the desert landscape. And then, new art will be displayed daily in the gallery at the Borrego Arts Institute, and an awards ceremony and reception will take place March 9th. The Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca invites you to Tomato Mania, the world's largest tomato seedling sale. Tomato Mania will be held March 8th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and again March 9th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Find rare heirloom tomato seedlings as well as expert advice on how to grow them. Learn more at tomatomania.com. Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa will present the comic play Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. The show runs March 1st through 24th. During an ostentatious wedding reception at a Tennessee estate, five reluctant, identically clad bridesmaids hide out in an upstairs bedroom, each with her own reason to avoid the proceedings below. As the afternoon wears on, these five very different women joyously discover a common bond in this wickedly funny, irreverent, and touching celebration of women's spirit. For tickets, visit lamplighterslamesa.com. The Mount Helix Park Foundation will host Nature Day atop Mount Helix March 2nd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. This event celebrates the historic nature preserve, native plants, and wildlife. There will be fun for all ages, from kids' activities to learning lectures. Vendors from nature-minded organizations will also have booths, crafts, and activities. You can bring a picnic or buy lunch from food trucks. There will be no parking on Mount Helix, but you can take a complimentary shuttle from the fire station at the corner of Avera and Mount Helix Drive. Get details at mounthelixpark.org. Now here's an event to squeal about. A tradition since 1947, the Eastern San Diego County Junior Fair will be held on Sunday, March 17th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds. Future Farmers of America and 4-H members will be exhibiting and auctioning livestock they have raised. You can also savor slow-cooked barbecued meats and vie for raffle prizes, as well as get more information about 4-H and FFOA. All proceeds will benefit the nonprofit Eastern San Diego County Junior Fair. Country music singer and songwriter Lyle Lovett will perform live in concert at the Magnolia Theater in El Cajon on March 24th at 7 p.m. Lovett has won 4 Grammy Awards, including Best Country Vocal Performance and Best Country Album. He's recorded 13 albums and released 25 singles, including the hit song Cowboy Man. For tickets, you can visit MagnoliaSanDiego.com. Mission Trails Regional Park and the San Diego Astronomy Association invite you to a star party on the first Friday of each month at sunset at the Kumeyaay Lake Campground parking lot. The next star party is April 5th. Telescopes will be available to view the nighttime sky, including stars, planets, and constellations, weather permitting. Get more information at Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org. Cajon Classic Cruises roars open this season on Wednesday night, April 12th, with a full street closure for the car shows at Main and Magnolia, along with fun, food, and entertainment for the whole family. Cajon Classic Cruises will continue all summer long each Wednesday night from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. April 19th will be Girls Night Out, and on April 26th, Cajon Classic Cruises will celebrate the event's 20th anniversary. You can get a full schedule of events at downtownelcajon.com. The City of La Mesa invites residents, visitors, and others to join its family-friendly Earth Day Fair on Saturday, April 20th at MacArthur Park. This festival is a celebration of the city's commitment to environmental stewardship and a showcase of local businesses that offer eco-friendly products and services. The festival will run from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. and feature a variety of activities for all ages and interests. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County. This is Miriam Raftery with a reminder to vote if you haven't already done so in the Tuesday, June 5th primary election. You can mail in your ballot or drop it off at any of the voting centers around San Diego County. And if you're not sure where those are or you need more help, you can go to sdvote.com.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Sounds of History on the East County Magazine show. April is Women's History Month. It's an appropriate time to share a story about a remarkable woman from East County's past. Helen Stoddard, a former resident of La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Ramona, was a prominent leader in the fight to win women the right to vote, as well as in the temperance movement. She even earned a place in history at the national political level. Born in 1850 in Wisconsin, Stoddard earned a teaching degree at Genesee Wesleyan Seminary in New York, graduating as valedictorian in 1873. She married Shepherd Stoddard and had 2 sons, one of whom died in infancy. They lived briefly in Nebraska, but soon her husband's health was failing, so the family moved to Florida. And after he died in 1875, when Helen Stoddard was just 25 years old, she and her surviving young son moved to Texas to be near her parents. There, she became president of the Texas State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, concerned over the negative impacts of alcoholism on women and their families. She also served on the faculty of Fort Worth University and helped establish a women's industrial arts college that today is known as Texas Women's University, where 2 buildings were named after her. She became an activist, lobbying successfully for a pure food law and laws against cocaine, gambling, child labor, raising the age of protection for girls from 12 to 15 in Texas, and more. She spent 3 months in Mexico as an organizer and twice served as a delegate to world conventions of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She also wrote an article on the Texas suffrage movement for Susan B. Anthony's book, History of Woman Suffrage. In 1910, Helen Stoddard and her son moved to La Mesa, where she was soon elected president of the La Mesa Women's Club, which incidentally was founded in 1902 and is the city's oldest active service club today. She also headed up the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Society, forerunner of the Prohibition movement. Local women embarked on barnstorming tours across the county to win support from men for women to gain the right to vote in California. La Mesa's newspaper and other local papers editorialized in favor of granting this right, since progressives in the region recognized that women would be key allies in local political issues and supporting social reforms related to child labor, public health, and regulating alcohol and vice. La Mesa Scout editorialized that the right of women to vote is as absolute as that of a man. In October 1911, California's legislature amended the state constitution, granting women the right to vote. Days later, Helen Stoddard loaded up motor cars with about 40 members of the La Mesa Women's Club and headed to the Registrar of Voters office in downtown San Diego, registering them all to vote. In La Mesa, then known as La Mesa Springs, a battle was brewing over incorporation to become a city. Supporters wanted the city to control its own water supply and support public education, among other goals. But there was strong opposition, mainly from ranchers who feared that their taxes would go up. Early efforts at incorporation faltered until the women got involved and won the right to vote. A meeting at the La Mesa Opera House on December 1, 1911, ended in disorder without a vote on whether to incorporate after vocal opponents showed up. Supporters brought their case to the supervisors, and among the speakers arguing to the supervisors was suffrage leader Helen Stoddard. The district attorney reviewed the petition but rejected it at first for not meeting requirements to publish notices 3 times over 2 weeks. So the supporters circulated a new petition and adjusted boundaries to remove some of their key opponents. In February 1912, a new meeting was convened at the city's Opera House, a building that today is the Por Favor restaurant in downtown La Mesa. Citizens nominated candidates for public office in case the incorporation petition passed, and Helen Stoddard was nominated to serve, but she declined. Turned out she had higher ambitions, and we'll tell you about that in a minute. On February 7, 1912, a special election was held, and the incorporation measure passed with help from La Mesa's newly registered women. Soon after, Stoddard declared her intention to run for Congress on the Prohibition Party ticket. She was the first woman in California to seek national office. Her campaign targeted women with the slogan, "A vote for Helen Stoddard is a vote for the home." She didn't win, but she did draw over 1,300 votes out of over 20,000 cast for 5 candidates in the race. A year later, she and her son Robert and his wife moved to Lemon Grove, where they spent the next 10 years, and in 1923, they moved to Ramona, where her son raised turkeys and chickens, while his mother continued her work in the temperance movement from their home overlooking the Ramona High School. In 1920, Helen Stoddard was elected president of the California State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she served as a California delegate to the Congress Against Alcoholism in Washington, D.C. After her son's death in 1936 in Ramona, Stoddard and her daughter-in-law moved to Texas. Helen Stoddard died there in January 1941 at age 90, and her body was returned to San Diego for burial next to her son at Greenwood Memorial Park. She had lived through the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and the dawn of World War II. Born in the pioneer era, in her lifetime she advanced education of women and saw women win the right to vote, helped lead the successful fight for La Mesa to become a city, ran for national political office, fought for the passage of the Prohibition Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but also lived to see that repealed. Throughout her life, she was a tireless fighter for the rights of women and girls, touching the lives of people across our nation to this day.
Our East County Magazine radio show needs volunteers, and so does our award-winning news website at eastcountymagazine.org. If you would like to help write scripts, learn reporting skills, research topics for our news team, or have an on-air voice to be the media, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
The Public News Service DOAA Newscast, March the 4th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. The most powerful California blizzard of the season pounded the Sierra Nevada with gusts up to 190 miles per hour, while heavy snow Sunday forced the closure of key roads to Lake Tahoe and the Mammoth Mountain areas. That from the LA Times. They report that a rare blizzard warning was extended through this morning for the Lake Tahoe area. Gusts greater than 100 miles per hour expected on the Sierra ridges through early Monday, according to the Weather Service. And Minnesota already had a law calling for 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040. Now there's a similar plan for transportation. A legislative committee will consider the idea today.
The Clean Transportation Standard has a target year of 2050 for phasing out carbon-intensive fuel sources for cars and trucks. Producers slow to adapt would have to buy credits, while companies distributing cleaner products would receive incentives. Transportation accounts for about a quarter of Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions, and Fresh Energy's Margaret Turney Hendricks says this approach could help reduce that total. She points to newer types of biofuels beyond standards like ethanol.
For example, winter oil seeds are better for the environment. They require much less fertilizer.
Under the bill, fuel sources would be graded on their carbon intensity to determine where they rate with the standard. Skeptics, including some environmental researchers, say the plan could have unintended consequences in reducing emissions. I'm Mike Moen.
This is Public News Service.
A farm advocacy group says large corporate agricultural producers are getting federal environmental safeguard funds that were intended for smaller operations.
The Inflation Reduction Act has provided $3 billion for conservation programs designed to shore up farm-related environmental safeguards, many focused on concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Farm Action President Angela Huffman says a recent shift in Biden administration policy has allowed money intended for small or medium-sized farmers, who've often been underserved by USDA policies, to wind up in the hands of corporate CAFOs.
They're already raking in a lot of taxpayer-funded subsidies, so we're really urging USDA to reconsider this recent decision.
The latest data show Montana is home to more than 120 CAFOs, just a fraction of the national total of more than 120,000, but significant in a state that has decreased environmental regulations. Large-scale ag operators say they also are looking for ways to be more environmentally friendly while meeting growing consumer demand for safe, high-quality foods. I'm Mark Moran.
Meantime, two-thirds of folks in Colorado who have lost their health insurance during Medicaid's so-called unwinding process are still eligible for coverage, but were terminated due to administrative errors.
According to a new Colorado Center on Law and Policy brief, Catherine Wallett, the center's legal director, says she's heard from people who have been forced to postpone critical heart surgery due to lack of coverage.
Or a child who had cancer treatment who had to stop his treatment for a period of time because the family couldn't afford it, but in fact he was eligible for Medicaid during the time that he was terminated. So the costs are high.
Medicaid coverage renewed automatically during the pandemic, but that policy ended in April of last year. I'm Eric Galatis.
Finally, from our Joe Ulurey, Indiana teachers know more than anyone about the power of words. They're speaking out about proposed legislation touted to make students smarter.
Citing a few sentences tucked away in the 16 pages of House Bill 1304. The bill outlines ways to improve math and reading proficiency in grades K through 12. Ashley Zorns, who teaches at Anderson Community Schools, says she supports most of the ideas in the bill. However, she was stunned to read new language which draws collective bargaining into the equation.
I want to know why our lawmakers are so honestly obsessed with unions and collective bargaining. What is it that they are afraid of? Because on my end and all of my peers' end, collective bargaining only benefits students and teachers.
Zorn says the language is shocking because other states have adopted similar legislation.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for starting your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Programs intended to reduce the chances that someone will end up back behind bars are working, according to a new analysis of California state data. A new report finds that people who participated in a social program funded by Proposition 47 had a recidivism rate of 15.3%, compared with 35-45% for people traditionally incarcerated by the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. Linda Penner chairs the California Board of State and Community Corrections, which produced the report.
These results indicate that Prop 47 is delivering the results voters wanted. Safer communities where individuals who commit low-level crimes are directed to housing, employment, mental health, and substance use services instead of prison.
Proposition 47 raised the threshold for a theft to qualify as a felony, which lowered the number of people getting jail time. It has saved the state $800 million in incarceration costs since it passed in 2014, money that was reinvested in social programs that help justice-involved people get back on their feet. Sean Huff works with Shields for Families, Inc., a nonprofit social services organization in South Central Los Angeles. He applauds the focus on crime prevention.
When you are able to address those issues, you're attacking some of the root causes of crime, and you keep people from feeling like they have no other choice but to go back to crime or to commit crime. But you really help to address the issues that led them to make those decisions in the beginning.
The analysis also found that 60% of people experiencing homelessness who make it through the program end up finding a stable place to live. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. More than 6 million Californians stopped out of college before getting a degree, and now a new report lays out a plan to bring them back on campus. Researchers from the nonprofit California Competes in Oakland interviewed more than 50 students they call comebackers for the report, entitled From Setback to Success, Meeting Comebacker Students Where They Are. Laura Bernhardt is a senior researcher at California Competes and notes that students say when it comes to outreach, an encouraging personal call from the school is much more effective than a form letter or email.
Some of them just said if someone had just reached out and assured me that taking a break is fine and outlined what steps I need to do to be able to come back, that that would have been very helpful.
The report also praises schools such as Shasta College and Sacramento State, which have flexible options where classes can be taken online or in compressed 8-week terms rather than the typical 16-week term. These schools and California Competes are part of a collaborative called California Attain, which aims to increase educational attainment and economic mobility of California adults who have some college but no credential. Bernhard says often students are hesitant to return because they can't afford to pay back fees or fines they may have racked up in the past.
Research has shown that if you actually waive some of these fees and institutional debt, more students are likely to return, and that will obviously lead to more tuition income. So it can actually be a very beneficial initiative for colleges to take.
Schools are encouraged to show students of all ages, not just recent high school graduates, in their marketing materials. The report also advises schools to reframe their language around academic probation, letting students know that it is just a temporary setback, not a reason to get discouraged. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk today about some plants you can plant to bring in hummingbirds. Everybody loves them. Nobody wants to fill those feeders. They get ants in them. They get bees in them. They get mold in them. And someday I'll convince my husband to quit putting sugar water in them and feeding them, because there's enough in my yard to keep every hummingbird in East County quite happy for quite a while. So what do you want to put in your yard that will bring in the hummingbirds? My favorite plant is a cultivar of a native plant. It is called Galvezia firecracker. If you go to most nurseries nowadays, this plant has become so popular that you can get it. Just ask for firecracker, which is different than Russellia. It's a Galvezia, G-A-L-V-E-Z-I-A. This is a plant that gets to be about 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it has red tubular flowers. And that's the key, isn't it? Red tubular flowers. That's what brings in the hummingbirds. They love it. Can't stay away from them. This is a much more manageable and nice plant than the Cape honeysuckle with the big orange flowers and the plant that gets to be 15 feet tall and 20 feet wide and goes everywhere and is a big floppy mess. Try a firecracker and see what you think. You can grow it in the sun, in the shade, in part sun, in part shade, with a lot of water or with just a little bit of water, and it will be fine. I have a neighbor who grows it under pepper trees, and the gardeners come every week and prune them into little round balls, and they never really get to bloom, and those trees have suffered through that for the last few years without a single one of them dying. Now that's what I would call an obliging plant. Another good plant that will bring in lots and lots of wildlife to your garden, and hummingbirds especially, is called California fuchsia. It's called Epilobium. Some of you may have known it in the past as Zauschneria. What a great name. So there's a good password for you, Zauschneria. Who's going to use a word like that for their password? Zauschnerias, or Epilobiums, California fuchsia, are a gray plant, and they have a bright orange-red tubular flower. Once again, great for hummingbirds, really keeps them happy. This is a plant that will actually spread slightly on its own and will get by even if something bad happens to the irrigation and nobody irrigates it for 6 weeks or 6 months. It won't die. It'll be fine. Anytime you go to a nursery, look around and look for the plants that have the red tubular flowers. That's the key to hummingbirds. Now, my friend Maureen Austin, who puts on the Sage and Songbirds Festival every year, says there's two kinds of wildlife-attracting plants out there. There's ice cream cones, which we're talking about now. These are the tubular-shaped flowers that the hummingbirds like. Or there's pizzas, and pizzas are the flat flowers, the daisy-type flowers, that you see butterflies landing on. If you think about butterfly bush, Buddleia, which brings in all sorts of cute little butterflies, it also is fragrant. It's known as summer lilac here, or butterfly bush. Then if you take a close look at those purple spikes that grow on that bring in the butterflies, you'll see a whole bunch of little bitty flowers. And that's what the butterflies are landing on. That's what they like. So that's a great one. Probably the best butterfly plant that you can come up with, though, is always going to be the butterfly weed, milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. It has orange and red flowers on it, and it just grows like a weed in your garden. Not invasive, just reseeds very effectively. You will know that you have succeeded when you see interesting looking green caterpillars all over the plant, eating every leaf. In my garden, I pick them off and I move them to another milkweed after they eat all the leaves off one. I don't try to fight them because they're going to turn into monarch butterflies. So my garden is full of monarch butterflies, which I consider to be flying flowers. So keep in mind, butterfly milkweed is a great plant to add to your garden repertoire.
Our East County Magazine radio show needs volunteers, and so does our award-winning news website at eastcountymagazine.org. If you would like to help write scripts, learn reporting skills, research topics for our news team, or have an on-air voice to be the media, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617.
A new dog park has opened in San Diego's Allied Gardens neighborhood for pet owners to bring their dogs to frolic off-leash. The new park, next to the Allied Gardens pool on Glenroy Street, is larger than most other local dog parks. The park features logs for agility training and seating, plus separate fenced areas for both large and small dogs. San Diego City Councilman Raul Campillo spoke at the grand opening, stating, "I'm proud to deliver this dog park, the first ever city-funded off-leash dog park in District 7, for Allied Gardens residents and the surrounding Navajo area." The new dog park was funded with $389,000 in the city's fiscal year 2024 budget for installation and maintenance. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This is Miriam Raftery with a reminder to vote if you haven't already done so in the Tuesday, June 5th primary election. You can mail in your ballot or drop it off at any of the voting centers around San Diego County. And if you're not sure where those are or you need more help, you can go to sdvote.com.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County into Scanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.